So the hour of 1 o'clock having passed, it's now 1:04. I'm going to call to order the select committee or the subcommittee on legislative process reform. And I don't think I need to repeat this, but I will. This committee is meeting under House Rule 10.01, and the clerk will take the roll.
Pawlowski.
Here.
Wolgamott.
Present.
Doubt.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Garofalo.
Present.
Haley.
Present.
Liz Lagarde.
Present.
Moran. Moran. O'Neill.
Present.
Pinto.
Present.
Sandsted.
Present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, members. The first thing on the agenda, we're going to have a review from House Research on an overview of the Chapter 12 statute. Colby Sullivan is going to do the review. I'm going to ask that members hold questions until after each presentation, and then we'll open it up for questions. So, Mr. Sullivan, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and then begin.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. I am Colby Sullivan with the Nonpartisan House Research Department. And if Mr. Wirth would put up the PowerPoint presentation, thank you. I prepared a few slides for the committee on the governor's emergency powers under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 12. So next slide, please. Cover three main topics. I'll highlight some of the key provisions in Chapter 12. And I'll talk a bit about the history of the different laws the legislature has enacted over time, resulting in the governor's current set of emergency powers. And at the end, then, there will be time for questions. I'm available for questions, and there are other staff on the call as well, depending on what members are interested in. So I'll start out my overview of Chapter 12 and start in the very beginning of Chapter 12. There are a lot of words on this slide, but I wanted to give members a feel for the intent as expressed by the legislature, first in the early 1950s, but retained with a few modifications to this day. And in part, the policy declaration for Chapter 12 states that because of the existing and increasing possibility of the occurrence of natural and other disasters of major size and destructiveness, and in order to ensure that the state is adequately prepared to protect public health, peace, and safety, and to preserve the lives and property of the people of the state, the legislature finds and declares it necessary to confer upon the governor and local units of government the emergency and disaster powers provided in Chapter 12. So under Chapter 12, there are two main categories of emergency that a governor may declare. The first is a national security emergency. The law provides that this may be declared when the federal government indicates the imminence of a national security emergency or a major Minnesota disaster from enemy sabotage or other hostile action. The second category is the peacetime emergency, which is the main focus of this presentation. The law authorizes the governor to declare a peacetime emergency when an act of nature, a technological failure or malfunction, a terrorist incident, an industrial accident, a hazardous materials accident, or a civil disturbance endangers life and property, and local government resources are inadequate to handle the situation. For a peacetime emergency, the legislature has provided that they're limited in duration to 5 days, unless extended by the Executive Council for up to 30 days. The Executive Council is comprised of the state's constitutional officers, the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and state auditor. When declaring a peacetime emergency, the law requires the governor to immediately notify House and Senate majority and minority party leaders and to give the declaration prompt and general publicity and file it with the Secretary of State. Chapter 12 also prescribes a role for the legislature. If the governor determines the need to extend a peacetime emergency beyond 30 days and the legislature is not already in session, the governor must immediately call a special session of the legislature. By a majority vote of both the House and the Senate, the legislature may terminate a peacetime emergency that extends beyond 30 days. And the law provides explicitly that the legislature's ability to end a peacetime emergency does not limit the governor's authority under other law in the Constitution to have control and command over the Minnesota National Guard. Next slide, please. So within Chapter 12, then, when the governor has declared an emergency, that invokes certain emergency powers for the duration of the emergency. And there are a number of them that I'll go through in the following slides. I haven't listed, or won't cover every emergency power. Some are relatively minor and not as relevant to the current COVID-19 emergency. But I'll hit on I think, the most significant ones. And the first one I'll highlight is the power to cooperate with the federal government and other states in matters pertaining to emergency management, including the direction and control of citizens and others in the state, including their entrance or exit from any stricken or threatened public place, as well as facility occupancy, direction and control of public meetings or gatherings, the evacuation, reception, and sheltering of persons, and the movement of pedestrians and all forms of public and private transportation. Chapter 12 also authorizes the governor to require any person, except for members of the military and officers of the state or local units of government, to perform emergency management services. Governor may commandeer for emergency management purposes private property, such as motor vehicles, tools, appliances, medical supplies, other personal property, and any facilities with prompt compensation required. A governor may order temporary care facilities to care for seriously ill or injured persons if their regional hospital system is overwhelmed. Acting through the Department of Health, the governor may also, during an emergency, order a person who refuses treatment, testing, or vaccination into isolation or quarantine. The governor may authorize the Department of Education to alter school schedules, curtail school activities, or order schools closed. The governor may also transfer the direction, personnel, or functions of state agencies as necessary to perform or facilitate emergency response and recovery. The governor may request aid from professionals who are licensed in another state or Canada with corresponding Minnesota license requirements waived while the person is rendering aid. So for example, a governor could request aid from medical professionals licensed in a neighboring state, and they would not be required to have a Minnesota license to practice while they are rendering aid in the state. Last slide on emergency powers, the final four I'll discuss here. The legislature has authorized the governor during an emergency to skip time-consuming procedures and formalities, that's the language directly from the law, and enter into contracts and incur obligations that the governor believes are necessary to protect the health and safety of persons and the safety of property or to provide emergency assistance to victims. The governor may direct the safe disposition of dead human bodies as reasonable and necessary for emergency response, as well as limit visitations and funerals due to public health risks. The governor may alter or adjust the working hours, leave, and payroll of executive branch employees, conforming to applicable state laws, rules, and CBAs, collective bargaining agreements, to the extent practicable. And finally, during an emergency, the governor may require local emergency management agencies to execute and enforce the governor's orders and rules. So in order to carry out the powers I've just described, the legislature has authorized the governor during an emergency to make, amend, and rescind executive orders and rules that are necessary to carry out the provisions of Chapter 12 without going through the formal rulemaking process that wouldn't normally be required outside of an emergency. The law provides further that these orders and rules issued by the governor have the full force and effect of law during the emergency if they are approved by the Executive Council and filed with the Secretary of State. finally, the law provides that during the period of the emergency, any inconsistent agency rule or local ordinance is suspended to the extent that the emergency exists. Finally, Chapter 12, there's a default criminal penalty. The language provides that unless a different penalty or punishment is specifically prescribed, a person who willfully violates a provision of Chapter 12 or a rule or order having the force and effect of law and issued by the governor under authority of Chapter 12 is guilty of a misdemeanor and upon conviction punishable by a fine not to exceed $1,000 or imprisonment for not more than 90 days. So in the final part of the presentation here, I want to highlight just a few of the significant laws that the legislature has enacted over time. Next slide, please. Thank you. Starting in 1951 with the Minnesota Civil Defense Act. And according to my research, after the Soviet Union successfully detonated a nuclear weapon, the United States Congress enacted the Federal Civil Defense Act of 1950. And that federal act provided for shared responsibility for civil defense among the federal government, state governments, and local units of government, recognizing that with the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles, America's adversaries might not assemble for an invasion at the nation's borders where the U.S. military could respond, but could instead initiate a war by launching a missile into the country's interior, where states and local governments would be the first to respond. So after Congress took the step of passing that federal act, the following year, in 1951, Minnesota lawmakers enacted the corresponding state law, the Minnesota Civil Defense Act, 1951. And among other things, the state law declared that in order to provide for the common defense and protect the public peace, health, and safety. So this first item is basically the purpose statement that I read to you earlier. It dates back to the Civil Defense Act of 1951. The act also authorized the governor to declare a civil defense emergency that could last up to 30 days and only in the event of an actual attack on the United States or a major disaster from enemy sabotage or other hostile action. This is the precursor to today's national security emergency that's still in law. This was the origin of the governor's authority, in this case, only during a civil defense emergency to make, amend, and rescind orders and rules that have the force and effect of law with the suspension of any conflicting agency rules or local ordinances. And finally, the Civil Defense Act required the governor, if the legislature was not already in session, to immediately convene the House and Senate when declaring a civil defense emergency. Jumping ahead a couple of decades to 1979, according to my research, it was in 79 that the legislature authorized the governor for the first time to declare a peacetime emergency. And although I've looked, it's not clear to me what prompted the legislature to authorize the peacetime emergency. Working with the excellent staff in our legislative reference library, the only historical clue that we could find was a brief 1979 newspaper article that quickly described the bill and said it was likely to pass the House with little or no debate. And that may be because the effect of declaring a peacetime emergency in 1979 was, in my opinion, significantly more limited than it is today. The law said the governor could declare a peacetime emergency when an act of nature, industrial accident, or hazardous materials accident endangers life and property, and local government resources are inadequate. And the effect was that when declaring a peacetime emergency, it would essentially invoke specific aspects of the state's civil defense plan, particularly the response and recovery aspects, as well as authorizing the governor to award aid, presumably to local units of government. And 1979 was the origin of the language that exists to this day that limits the duration of a peacetime emergency to 5 days unless extended by the Executive Council. Moving on to 1996, there was significant modernization of Chapter 12. And so much so that the legislature renamed Chapter 12 at that time the Minnesota Emergency Management Act of 1996 after the law that changed it significantly. Among other things, the 1996 law changed the Minnesota statute Chapter 12 language and programs to sort of broaden and expressly address emergencies generally, including natural disasters. It looks like it may have been an effort to align state programs with federal aid programs through the Federal Emergency Management Agency so that the state would be well positioned to apply for and receive federal aid through FEMA. The legislature at that time changed the name of the Civil Defense Emergency to its current name, the National Security Emergency, and added civil disturbance to the list of events for which a governor could declare a peacetime emergency. Next, in 1999, in preparation for the new millennium and potential computer or other problems attributable to Y2K, the legislature amended Chapter 12 again, this time adding additional events which would authorize the governor to declare a peacetime emergency, those events being a technological failure or malfunction, as well as a terrorist incident. The next event, in 2002, and there were significant changes to Chapter 12 as part of the Minnesota Emergency Health Powers Act. And it was after the terrorist incidents of September 11, 2001, were followed by an anthrax public health scare. According to my research, the Department of Health, Minnesota Department of Health, proposed a new state law based on a Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that was prepared by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And after significant debate in the legislature and many committee hearings and amendments, the legislature enacted the Minnesota Emergency Health Powers Act in 2002. But I think due in part to the controversy at the time, the legislature required a report that would help the legislature gather additional information and set a sunset date of 2 years out, 2004, so that the legislature could revisit the law at that time. So among other things, the Health Powers Act created a new public health emergency and authorized the governor to declare either a national security emergency or a peacetime emergency in response to a public health emergency. This is when the governor was given the power to restrict entrance or exit from any stricken or threatened public place, as well as occupancy of facilities and all forms of public and private transportation. I think also due to maybe some reservations among at least some of members of the legislature, there were a couple of, or at least one or two guardrails that were put in, one that provided that an emergency declared due to a public health emergency would automatically terminate 30 days after declaration unless renewed by the governor. Importantly, the legislature in 2002 provided that the governor's orders and rules that are issued during a peacetime emergency declared due to a public health emergency would have the force and effect of law. And according to my research, this is the first time that a governor was able to issue orders and rules with the force and effect of law during a peacetime emergency. But in this case, the legislature said that that could only happen if the peacetime emergency was declared due to a public health emergency. The act did some other important things. It is the origin of some other powers that the governor has to this day, including compelling participation in emergency management, commandeering personal property and facilities, directing dead body disposition, limiting funerals and visitations. It required the governor, when declaring or renewing a peacetime emergency due to a public health emergency, to call the legislature into session at that time, as well as required the governor to notify not only House and Senate leadership, but also the chairs and ranking minority members of certain House committees, and to provide them with information about how this emergency may impact the public. And the 2002 law is the origin of the provision that remains to this day, authorizing the legislature to terminate a peacetime emergency, at that time just a public health emergency, at any time by a majority vote of each body. And the final item to discuss, it was in 2005. And After the legislature acted in 2004 to extend the 2002 public health law by one additional year, in 2005, the legislature enacted two laws that effectively retained portions of the 2002 law, modified some others, and allowed many of them to expire. And according to my research, as recommended by the Minnesota Department of Health at that time, the legislature allowed the separate public health emergency statutes to expire. And having listened to the tapes from that era, it was House Chief Author Representative Duke Powell's stated intent that because many different emergencies would have a public health component, the state would be better served by eliminating the separate public health emergency protocols and going forward, responding instead to public health and all other emergencies under a uniform all hazards approach in Chapter 12. So to accomplish that, the legislature repealed references to the public health emergency or simply allowed them to expire. Some of the pieces the legislature retained included the provision that authorized the legislature to end any peacetime emergency by a majority vote if it extends beyond 30 days. Remember previously in 2002, that applied only in the event that the governor declared a peacetime emergency due to a public health emergency. But as of 2005, the legislature's authority applies to all peacetime emergencies declared by the governor. They extend beyond 30 days. And then similarly, the 2002 language was retained that required the governor to call a special session in extending a peacetime emergency beyond 30 days. And then significantly, the last bullet point is that in 2005, as part of this all hazards approach, the legislature for the first time authorized the governor to exercise the Chapter 12 emergency powers and issue orders and rules that have the full force and effect of law during any peacetime emergency, regardless of the purpose for which it was called or declared in the first place. That's the end of my presentation. If members have questions, I or others will try to answer them.
Members, thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Are there any questions, members?
Yes, hi, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
How you doing? One, I'm here. But two, can we get a copy of this?
Representative Moran, I believe these were sent to us, but we will certainly send it if you didn't get it. So you'll get a copy of it.
All right. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a really interesting history. It's something that I was wondering about how all of this came to be. I still have a question because it seems like we're still not following Chapter 12 exactly as it is today. And my question is the majority vote part. It's something that my constituents have asked me repeatedly. It says clearly that a majority vote of the House, majority vote of the Senate is enough to stop and end the emergency powers. And yet in the House, at close to 10 times, we've had to, not quite 10, maybe 7 times now, we've had to achieve a 90% or a 90 vote, which is a 2/3 majority, to suspend the rules to get to the ability to do a majority vote. And they don't do that in the Senate. The Senate just goes straight to a majority vote. Can you tell me why that is? Why is it that we're not following Chapter 12 according to what's written here and what you just described with a simple majority vote of 68 votes to end the peacetime emergency? And I do have a follow-up after that too. Mr. Chair, would you like me to ask that now or do you want me to do it?
No, why don't we get this one? Let's get this one done and then we'll go to your next one. How's that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Mr. Sullivan, do you wish to respond?
Mr. Chair and members, the Director of House Research, Patrick McCormick, is on this call as well. And if possible, I'd like to defer to him to answer that question.
Sure, Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. The differences between legislative procedures and a substantive vote on Chapter 12. Legislative procedures allow the interposition of House rules to require that a resolution or a bill be brought to the floor under a condition which in some cases requires a 2/3 vote. For example, If you want to suspend rules and declare an emergency under the Constitution, that requires a two-thirds vote prior to voting on the subsequent motion. Or if you want to bring a bill out of committee, and the House procedures, whether it's a happy matter for you or not, the House procedures allow the majority to interpose the two-thirds vote as a prior step to doing a vote on Chapter 12.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I actually have a follow-up to that now that he said that.
All right.
Mr. McCormick, if you could explain to myself and to the public, if it is different now that we are fully in session, than needing the 90 votes or the two-thirds majority to suspend the rules to bring a resolution, are we still under that rule of the House now that we're fully in session, or has that now changed, reverted back to a simple majority? If you could explain that to me and to the public. Thank you,
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, under House rules, a resolution can be brought out of committee or a bill can be brought out of committee with a simple majority. That rule has not been changed. And early in session, we had a vote on whether to bring the resolution ending the governor's peacetime emergency out of committee. If 68 members had voted yes, that would have been brought out of committee and brought to the floor. 68 votes were not there, and so the resolution was not brought out of committee.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McCormick, for that. I know that that is a question that is asked so often, and I think the public will appreciate that answer coming from you, Mr. McCormick, that have been there decades as a nonpartisan expert in parliamentary procedure. Okay, now another question actually for Mr. Sullivan, if I might. It has to do with the history of this. It really has evolved since 1951 when it was first instituted. And the biggest changes seem to me to be the 2002 and 2005 iterations of this. And the portion of this that is the most problematic, I think, for us as a legislature to have equal authority and equal power with the legislative branch, and what the public is the most frustrated with, I might add, is the fact that the governor and the executive branch has been allowed to continue past the 30 days. And as you see through this whole iteration of this particular part of statute, Chapter 12, that was not extended until 2002. So I get it, after September 11th, the governor could then extend it past 30 days. But let me ask you this, as they were grasping with this, trying to understand this, and they even did a sunset, there was a decision obviously made that instead of the legislature needing to vote to approve the continuation of the emergency, they have to vote to stop the emergency. And that is a very, very, very different story. You know, Minnesota historically has been a divided government. And so that seems to kind of quench the minority's voice and power. And I'm just wondering if in your research you found out, why did they do that? Why did the legislature, and it was interesting to me as I researched too, that the 2002 change was under Ventura, so not a Republican or a Democrat. So just wondering if you have any historical background as to why that decision was made, because that certainly has become incredibly problematic for the voices of the minority and very, very loud voices of our citizens. Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, I listened closely to the tapes of legislative committee hearings, House and Senate, and floor debates in 2005, but I have not, but I will, to research your question, go back and find the tapes for 2002, because as you pointed out correctly, that's when the legislature's ability to end a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days began. I know in 2005, that was one of the provisions that was set to expire. And in a House committee, I think it was the Public Safety Committee, I'd have to go back and look, via amendment, that was the legislature made sure that that ability to terminate a peacetime emergency was retained as other parts of the 2002 law expired. But I don't know the answer from the tapes to your question of what happened in 2002 and if the legislature, if members of the legislature debated how that mechanism should work and what other alternatives existed. But I will look into that, and I will get back to members of the committee.
Representative O'Neill.
Yep, I just want to thank you for all of that. Those are my questions, but I would point out that these are incredibly problematic things, and I realize they were debated in the past, but also to point out that this has effectively silenced the voice of the minority and very loud voices of the citizens of Minnesota, and it's something that we absolutely have to deal with. This is unacceptable moving forward. I don't know who thought that was a great idea. I could list off the governors and the leaders of the House and the Senate, but you can look it up for yourself and to see what happened in 2002 and 2005. Thank you.
Representative Lanier, we'll have Mr. Sullivan give a better answer or a fuller answer to you at our next meeting. So after he reviews those tapes.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Sandstead.
I have no question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just wanted to follow up on those questions for Representative O'Neill. The decision to make these changes in 2002, 2005, presumably those were approved by legislative majorities at the time. So the majority made the decision to do that. Is that right, Mr. Sullivan, perhaps Mr. McCormick?
Mr. Sullivan or Mr. McCormick, who wants to field that one?
Mr. Chair, I can take that one. And Representative Pinto. Yes, that's correct. All of the provisions that I described, all of the changes to Chapter 12 were enacted by a majority of both the House and the Senate.
And Mr. Sullivan, just to be clear, you're going to, at our next meeting, you'll do an answer to Representative O'Neill. I just want to make sure that you're aware that we're requesting of it.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I'll do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just I believe that there was actually a Republican majority in both 2002 and 2005 and the Republican governor in 2005. Am I right about that?
Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe the House was in Republican control. I believe I'm trying to remember when Governor Plenty was elected. I know he was governor in 2005. I think he probably was governor in 2002. Others, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure about the majority in the Senate at the time.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I had in my mind the House majority. As a House partisan, I think, along with many members of the committee, they're a Republican control of the House. I think there probably was a DFL Senate in both those times, and then Governor Plenty in 2005. I think Representative O'Neill pointed out Governor Ventura in 2002. So my apologies, Mr. Chair and members. And I guess then just one other follow-up question. I was concerned in the questioning of our House staff that there was an implication maybe that Chapter 12 was not being followed in terms of legislative process. So I just want to make sure that that there's no concern that in the process that's been followed that there's been some violation of Chapter 12 by the legislature in terms of how it's acted or hasn't acted. Just that line about their, you know, the majority vote of each House and may terminate the emergency, et cetera. And I want to make sure that our House research staff is not aware of some violation or mistake by the House in terms of Chapter 12.
Mr. McCormick or Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Pinto. No, there's nothing in Chapter 12 that mandates a vote of the House and Senate to end the emergency. It's discretionary. The House can choose to have a vote. The Senate can choose to have a vote. And if they don't want to choose to have a vote, that de facto continues the emergency.
Thank you for that. And thanks for the really helpful presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are there any other questions on this area? Seeing none, before I move to the next presentation, I want to draw the members' attention to a letter you should have received from Governor Walz. This letter is dated today, January 21st. I'm sorry, yesterday, January 21st. It's to legislative leaders. You might want to take a look at it. It's in reference to the letter that he sent on January 7th. The letter does mention the work of this committee and the governor's willingness to work with us now that we are in session. So having that letter in our possession, I'm going to move to the next series of presentations. And the first I have is Assistant Commissioner Dan Huff. Welcome to the committee and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Huff. I am Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm actually going to be sharing my presentation with my colleagues, Joe Kelly and Cheryl Peterson-Krober. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to ask Mr. Kelly to start the presentation.
Mr. Kelly, welcome to the committee, or Director Kelly, and please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Pulaski and members, good afternoon for the record. I am Joe Kelly, and I serve as the state's Emergency Management Director with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. I enjoyed and appreciated the excellent overview of Chapter 12 by Mr. Sullivan, and that good work allows me to keep my remarks very short with the intention of providing some context of the law to the pandemic response that we at the Department of Public Safety from the State Emergency Operations Center have been supporting for the last 313 days. And Mr. Wirth, if you could, would you please put our slides up? Thank you, sir. Next slide, please. Specific to peacetime emergencies and emergency powers members, typically emergencies are declared and those authorities are used for actions like activating the National Guard, lifting weight limits on roads to facilitate bringing in materials to build emergency flood protection, and even recognizing other states' commercial driver's license credentials to get utility crews into the state to help replace poles and restring power lines. And compared to the full potential heft of the statute, that's pretty modest stuff, particularly if you look back, as Mr. Sullivan took us through, all the way back to 1951 and the prospect of thermonuclear war. Next slide, please. This slide, I know it's very difficult to read, and it's more of the colors than anything, but it illustrates the unprecedented scope of state support to an emergency response. The center column from about the third dark blue block down, as well as those two yellow blocks, represent the temporary leadership structures and work groups that have been needed to support the response and prevent the uncontrolled spread of the virus across Minnesota. The interagency working groups that we are supporting from the State Emergency Operations Center include those for testing, healthcare surge, long-term care support, critical care supplies, education and child care, food security, at-risk populations, community resiliency and recovery, and of course, vaccinations. I have been involved in emergency response and disaster recovery in Minnesota for more than a quarter century, and I have never been part of a mobilization of all levels of government, and certainly nationwide and around the world, for an emergency like this one. And it strikes me that a major incident like this is much more the type of event that the original writers of Chapter 12 and those who have amended along the way had that in mind than some of the more common, admittedly limited, more limited natural disasters that we are all experienced with. From our perspective in the State Emergency Operations Center, the foundational peacetime emergency declaration provides us with the tools that we need to, quote, fast provide emergency aid, close quote. And that's what Mr. Sullivan was talking about on his slide, where he talked about being able to set aside temporarily some of those time-consuming procedures because we just need to do things quickly and have the agility to respond effectively. We simply can't do what we have needed to do for things like expediting purchases and contracts, hiring temporary workers, redeploying state employees, renting facilities and equipment, and effectively managing the money without the peacetime declaration. And I know that foundational executive order is just one of many that the legislature is interested in. Mr. Chair, subject to any questions at this time, I would turn the presentation back over to Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Next slide, please. What I'd like to do is to frame my presentation in our public health data, and specifically this chart here. And this chart is new cases per 100,000 people per day. And you see we start back in April 1st, and it goes all the way up up until yesterday. And what we see here is that we, as we know, we hit a surge in cases in May, and then we were able to go along really fairly steadily throughout the summer. And then into fall, we started to increase, and then we hit that fall surge where we became really at crisis levels in our healthcare sector and our hospitals. Following the governor's dial back and the excellent work of all of Minnesotans, we have turned that surge back to a dramatic decline and are a much better place than we were back Thanksgiving. Next slide, please. Our rate of hospitalizations, our rate of hospital admissions tracks to the number of cases we have. It tends to lag. But it is proportional to that. And that continues, next slide, with our ICU admissions. You'll see that there's a bit of a lag. People are tested, they are diagnosed, then they may end up in the hospital, and then from there, if they continue to get worse in ICU, next slide. And you see that deaths and lag behind that. But you can see that all of these correspond to the number of cases. It's all proportional. Next slide. If we look at how we have done compared to other states in the Midwest, what we had is Minnesota was a victim of this surge that happened in all of the states surrounding us. But you will see here that our surge is smaller and narrower than most of our neighboring states, specifically the Dakotas. We feel that this is a real indication of the success of Minnesota's COVID response and the emergency declaration under Governor Walz. We wish we could have prevented that surge, but it's very difficult when the sea is rising all around you. There's no such thing as a seawall that you can put around the state of Minnesota to prevent a disease from also spilling over. Next slide, please. What we have here, these each star represents when a state hit 1,000 deaths per, excuse me, one death per 1,000 people. So if you picture a Vikings game has about a capacity of 66,000 people, that means of those 66 of them die. You can see that we are one of the last states in our region to reach that level of 1,000 deaths, one death per 1,000 people. Next slide, please. As we look at what happened, why did we go, we were moving along fairly consistently. We had, we are in what we call a dial phase three, which is a lot of things are open with some restrictions in the state. And then all of a sudden we started to tick upwards, and you can see what happens with exponential growth. This is the challenge when we work with an infectious disease, is that an infectious disease tends to grow slowly, and then it hits a tipping point where you have enough people in the population that are infected and that then can spread the disease to other people who can spread it to other people, that you hit this exponential growth curve. And you can see that we were at 15 cases per 100,000 people there just after September 16th, we hit that. And then if you look on October 5th, it took us 3 weeks to get up to 20 cases per 100,000. And then 2 weeks later, we were at 30 cases. And then 2 weeks later, we were up over 100 cases per 100,000. That is when we hit exponential growth. At the levels that we are, exponential growth can tip on a dime. And that is why it is so important that we maintain vigilance, maintain these executive authority and these emergency powers to change with and pivot as the virus changes so quickly. Next slide, please. Show this slide. The virus changes over time. So this is just different weeks up into our current week, which is week one for the MMWR, our most recent week that's posted. You can see the darker blue represents higher case counts per county and the virus changes. It moves over time. Another thing that's important to note about here, there tends to be a popular misnomer that the metro is where we have more severe disease. And that's just not the case. And it has not been the case for many months. The more severe counties impacted have been outstate counties, primarily in the western and southern portions of our state. But as you can see, it has moved around to where it has impacted every single county in our state. This is truly a statewide emergency. Next slide. COVID is a serious disease. You've probably heard of the term COVID long haulers. It's an interesting disease. It attacks or attaches to ACE2 receptors on our cells. We happen to have this type of receptor in many of our cells. They concentrate on our lungs and our respiratory system. That is why COVID is predominantly a respiratory disease. However, we have ACE2 receptors in our nervous tissue, in our brains. We have them in our cardiovascular system, and we have them in our heart. And that is why we have seen an increase in cardiac arrests, heart attacks, pulmonary disease, encephalitis. And then sort of very interesting things, such as COVID toes, which is it's a cardiovascular effect. Where the virus is attacking this cardiovascular lining within our toes even. But that impacts the kidneys and also in rare cases provides a inflammatory disease in young children. Next slide, please. So going back to my original slide where you see that as cases rise, we also increase hospitalizations and ultimately death. It is proportional. We are right now at about 26 cases per 100,000 people. If we were at 30 cases per 100,000 people, we estimate then on the percentage of people that are impacted that we would see 170 Minnesotans die every week. If we were to increase to 150 cases per 100,000, and at our peak, we had 120, we would see 850 Minnesotans die in a week. Conversely, if we were able to go down back to closer where we were this summer, to 10 cases per 100,000, we would only see, still tragically, but much fewer, 60 deaths per week of Minnesotans. The lower we get our cases, the fewer people die, the fewer people are in the hospital. Next slide. We have and have been tracking for many months now one of the guideposts of Minnesota's response is transparency. And we at MDH have strived to provide the most transparent and complete data that we can. We've actually been nationally recognized with the completeness and the transparency of our data. But we have developed five public health risk measures that we continue to track. And these five are important because they interrelate with each other. I discussed case growth, but also in that is our testing positivity, our testing rate, because you have to be testing if the other measures are still going to maintain their validity, our hospitalization rate and community spread. That is how many people are infected with the disease and do not know where it came from, do not know that personal-to-person contact, just got it somewhere in the community. Next slide. Next slide. So if you look at the governor's executive orders, you can see back there in March was when we had our stay-at-home order. Once that stay-at-home order was really effective and reduced that first spring peak that we had, that was lifted. And we were in this phase three opening really for quite some time. And then in July, that face covering requirement was added for the statewide masking. As we began to see this alarming peak in the fall, the governor instituted first an executive order establishing a curfew in bars and restaurants and some other restrictions and that was followed quickly just because of the perilous place we were at in our hospitals with the dial back. And as cases have gone down, the governor issued 2101, which opened up and reversed the dial back. Next slide, please. Next slide. One thing to note about our context of how Minnesota has managed this, it is not just driven by one measure. If we were to only focus on the disease, we would limit all social interaction. We would end all interaction outside of the household, except for those in emergency situation. But we know that it is more than just a disease and the track of the disease that governs the health of our state. And so that is why there's been this context approach where we have looked at what is individual and societal well-being, is social, mental, physical, emotional health, what is our economic health, as well as how are we controlling the disease. It has been a balance approach of how do we balance listening to the health experts, listening to our economic experts, following the data based upon our knowledge and our science to maintain the balance of Stay Safe Minnesota. Next slide. Stay Safe has some guiding principles. We want to limit morbidity and mortality due to COVID-19. So mortality, that's when people die. But we also have people, as we talked about, those long haulers and those other effects of COVID. That's where we have morbidity, where many people have been severely impacted by the disease. We want to protect hospital capacity. We must have hospital bed space for people who need it, whether because they slip and fall on the ice or because they have COVID. And we want to make sure that businesses are as open as possible. It is this balance, however, that has been tricky. No one would have wished we were had to do what we did this last year. Unfortunately, the pandemic has created this unprecedented public health emergency. And undergirding all of this, imbued within all of this, is a focus on equity. And how are we making sure that we are not exacerbating current inequities and that we are looking at disparities? Next slide. When we look at anything that is how do we control the disease, we look at how the disease is spread. And the disease is spread when people are close to each other. How long people are together, the longer people are together, the more likely disease transfer can occur. Are people seated? Are they moving? Are they mixing with each other? Those things impact how the disease is able to opportunistically spread to others. Are people masked? We'll talk about masking more in a moment. How are households mixing? If I only stay in my household pod, we have circulated our germs with each other. But if I go with another household, now I'm introducing myself and that other household to a whole new set of germs that we will exchange with each other. COVID may be one of those. And then if we're outdoors or indoors, when we're outdoors, there's greater ventilation, sunlight, that UV radiation destroys the virus, a lot more ventilation moves the virus away from us. It's much safer outdoors than it is indoors. Next slide. As we have gone through this process, we have maintained relationships and maintain a consistent outreach and engagement approach, whether it be Commissioner Grove meeting with different sectors of the economy, Deputy Commissioner Mueller meeting with superintendents and school districts, Minnesota Public Health meeting with various sectors, Commissioner Tomes meeting with youth sports. We have had weekly meetings with various stakeholders throughout the state, consistently updating, getting input, seeking advice, addressing questions, making tweaks based upon their input. Next slide. One of the things that we have done, and we have worked with our businesses or organizations to develop preparedness plans, and they have focused on these categories to really get at the heart of how do we control the disease in each of these different settings. Next slide. We have guidance based upon the sector or the venue or that type of activity on what are the requirements and what are the recommendations for each sector. And it's tailored so that I can go, depending on where I fit in, and I can find the guidance that meets me, that speaks to my needs. Next slide. We also have continued to provide technical assistance and support. I talked about the stakeholder engagement we have. We continue that. We've done statewide webinars. We do presentations to member organizations. And we do individual consultation. We at the Department of Health, Department of Education, DEED, we continue to meet one-on-one with groups or in small groups to provide technical assistance to answer questions and help them provide a safe environment for their customers, their clients, and their employees. Next slide. So if we look at where is Minnesota? Well, Minnesota is not an outlier here. In all of these, we are actually middle of the pack. So you can see the number of states that have indoor social gathering restrictions in place. Next slide. Executive orders governing restaurant and bar service. Next slide. Governing gyms and fitness. Next slide. Or indoor venues, such as the Excel Center or U.S. Bank Stadium. Next slide. The face covering mandate, which was implemented in July 25th, we believe has been extremely successful in allowing us to maintain both that long run of summer where we'll be able to keep most of things open, really at a good place where we did not see increase in the disease. I want to talk to some of the reasons of why this is important. Next slide. First of all, we are by far not an anomaly in being having a mask mandate. The majority of states in the United States do have a mask mandate. Next slide. So if we think about how masks work, we need to think about how the disease spreads. Although the disease can attack cells throughout the body, it is primarily spread through respiratory expectorant. That is, if I breathe out, if I cough, if I sneeze, if I laugh, I sing, I am expelling air from my lungs, and that air is carrying moisture droplets with it. The virus hitches a ride in those droplets. Well, that mask traps the majority of those droplets so that they stay with me and I do not expel them. And those that are expelled don't expel very far because they've used most of their energy just getting through the mask. So what that means is that I am not as likely to spread the disease if I'm infected. The other thing, it actually does provide some filtration effect, so it actually protects me as a wearer as well. We have found that masks are very effective, and worldwide, this is a very, very common and one of the best mitigation measures employed to slow down and prevent COVID transmission. Next slide. It's very much based in the science. Just this last year, 25 studies looking at COVID, specifically on COVID, addressing the effectiveness of masking. And CDC has all of these published on their website as well. Both experimental data that is in the lab, observing how masks work, how aerosols work, as well as our epidemiologic data, all support the fact that masking limits the spread of the disease. Next slide. Since the governor implemented the masking mandate, you can see that in June 1st, although we were encouraging people to use masks, there was a lot of information out there. Public pressure to use masks, we were only at 47%. Today, now we're at 77% mask wearing. The more people wear masks, if we can get to 85 or 90%, that will continue to have an incredible impact on lowering the spread of the disease, saving lives. Next slide. And next slide. And I guess that's it for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Huff, I've got four members who have questions, so I'm going to go to Representative Garofalo first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I want to do an audio check. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I just want to make this comment. It's a general comment that pandemics suck, right? All the options are bad. They ruin lives, they destroy wealth, and they kill people. And so it's important that, as my understanding of this committee is that we're dealing with facts, and we should all recognize that there is no silver bullet popular way to get away from this. There's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. I view our committee as having a responsibility to avoid that and staying away from the social media vomit that we're seeing partisans proposing. So when it comes to the role of this committee, I guess I don't view it as debating the effectiveness or lack of the effectiveness of the governor's policies. I don't view it as the responsibility of this committee to be comparing us or contrasting us with states that have succeeded, failed, done better or worse than Minnesota. The question before us is that we're in the 11th month of a governor having special powers. And are we okay with that continuing, or are we not? It's a simple yes or no question. If we're going to continue to allow one person to make the decisions, then it doesn't really matter whether the decisions are good or bad. That's a secondary issue. The primary issue is whether we're going to have a role in this, or whether the governor is going to continue to make those decisions. And so there was many things that the commissioner addressed. I don't want to debate the merits or effectiveness of the policies or compare us to other states. But one of the comments you did make is you said that it was important that the governor maintain this authority. And I'm wondering why that is.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, thank you for your comments there. And I appreciate that pandemics do suck. It gives us with lots of poor choices. I will say that the governor, and I think the governor's letter speaks to itself, the governor is very interested in partnering with the legislature. I think we at the agency, we know that we have our best effectiveness when we are able to partner both between the executive and the legislative branches. So I would say that if I can amend my statement, what is important is that we have effective response, whether that response is through an emergency declaration, through some other type of work. I would say what's important is that we continue an effective response to the pandemic. I know I share with my colleagues, I share with the governor, the desire to make sure that we do this as collaboratively as possible. So thank you for pointing that out, and I'd like to correct that statement. So thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think you said it best, is that the focus needs to be on having an effective response. And there are I know there's defined narratives of members and parties. I think it's important to look back at the historical record that back in March, myself and other Republican legislators were actually calling for many of these initiatives to be enacted by the governor back in March, when we didn't know what we were dealing with, when we were seeing the disasters in Italy and New York, and we were fearful that was coming here. And so I do think it's important to recognize that there is a desire by many people in my party to be collaborative and work with the governor with the focus that exactly you mentioned there, Commissioner, having an effective response. Now, certainly I can pick apart parts of the governor's decision-making. Some has been effective, some of it's been quite ineffective, but I don't want to debate that today. I do want us to have a conversation in this committee about whether we are going to persist under this decision-making model. That is what I view my role as being in this committee. And Commissioner, I want to thank you for clarifying your comments. That it's incredibly meaningful, and I know that that means a lot to those of us on this committee. Thank you.
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. I do have a couple of questions for our testifiers, but before I get into that, I think it's important to remind both members of this committee, but also members of the public who might be watching this, that the state of Minnesota is no outlier in declaring a state of emergency to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, on the very same day that Governor Walz declared a state of emergency, President Donald Trump declared declared a state of emergency nationally to deal with this pandemic. And all 50 governors, Republican and Democrat alike, have used a peacetime state of emergency to respond to this pandemic. And in fact, Mr. Chair, to this very day, 49 out of the 50 states remain in a state of emergency for the same reasons that we currently are, so that we have the tools and the resources and the flexibility to respond to this pandemic and save Minnesotans' lives. Now to my questions. My first question is for Assistant Commissioner Huff. Assistant Commissioner Huff, can you tell us more about the MDH decision-making on that most recent dial back in November? What was the timing like on that decision when we were seeing that surge in cases?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. We were very concerned about those the cases that we were seeing, and I'm wondering if our administrator might be able to go back to slide number 11.
Mr. Wirth.
So one of the challenges with an infectious disease is you never know when it's going to hit exponential spread. We were getting those early, we were getting warning signs. We were starting to increase. Yes, thank you. That's it. So we can see that we started to have a little bit of increase. Now, we had had some increases before because things go up and down and up and down. But once we hit that exponential growth there in mid-October, that is when our alarm bells went off. The challenge, of course, is there's sometimes a lag between how much is already baked in the system. And when you it's think of a truck going down a mountain, when you apply the brakes, it still takes a while to slow down. Knowing that, but knowing that we don't want to apply the brakes to economic engine too soon, it is a definite balance there. So with our goals of wanting to limit mortality, limit death, but also making sure that the economy is as open as possible, we tapped the brakes with that first executive order, which was the curfew and limiting social activities of, you know, how many people we get together on a social basis or weddings and that kind of thing. But we realized that at this point we were going too fast down the hill and had to apply, apply the brakes. And Commissioner Malcolm had a discussion with the governor and said, "Governor, I'm very worried, and this is what the data shows us." And the governor took that here, heeded that warning, and that was when that dial back was applied.
Representative Waldemar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may ask one more question of Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Representative Waldemar.
Assistant Commissioner Huff, you sort of mentioned that balance between the economy and saving lives. Now, I noticed you earlier in your presentation, you showed that other states that have enacted similar restrictions to Minnesota. I know that there have been states that have actually had even more stringent restrictions than Minnesota, and that those restrictions have gone on for an even longer period of time. I know in my conversations with the governor and with his team at MDH, that my understanding is that that was done because you really have put thought into that, striking that balance of saving lives and keeping the economy open. So I guess my question is, why were there more states that had more stringent restrictions than us? And can you elaborate more on that balance between, keeping our economy open and keeping Minnesotans safe?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vice Chair, it's an excellent question. And as part of this response, the governor has honored different opinions and has fostered a group who have been willing to share and have very difficult conversations with each other. And we have wrestled. We have wrestled every single day with striking the right balance in this pandemic. As you say, there are many states that are much more stringent than Minnesota. I feel that the Minnesota approach has been successful. If we look at a state like North Dakota and we look at their death rate, if we had had their death rate, over 4,000 more Minnesotans would be dead. We have protected and saved lives. At the same time, I believe we have struck an important balance. It's, you know, unfortunately, there is no playbook on how a pandemic is going to unfold. This is a brand new disease. We are only just now learning the disease. But by being science-driven, by being nimble and flexible, we have been able to pivot as we need to. I appreciate that the governor has always listened to the experts, has taken different opinions into account in every one of his moves.
Representative Walgamont, any more questions?
No further questions, Mr. Chair. I just really want to thank you, Assistant Commissioner Huff, and applaud the work that you and everyone at MDH and the governor have done. The thoughtfulness you put into striking that balance, I think, is something that we should all be proud of. So thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions for Assistant Commissioner Huff, if I can proceed.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I'm not sure what slides maybe you need to go back to for this, but as you discussed decision-making and certain benchmarks on, you know, closings of our economy and mask wearing, et cetera, I wonder if you could also discuss then what are the benchmarks or the data points that you or the governor are looking for in order to change those decisions, for example, getting, you know, businesses fully open, kids back in school. What's the other side of the coin there?
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haley, and Mr. Chair, with your permission, if the administrator could go to slide 15.
Mr. Wirth.
Thank you, Mr. Wirth. So these are the dial back or public health risk measures that we have published on the website, and these are updated regularly. Now, we have a lot of measures that we look at, but these, we chose these specifically because they look at different parts of the pandemic. And you'll see here, Representative, that we have, I guess what you'd call like the green zone, which in this case is white. That's good. Yellow is our caution zone, and the red is the high risk zone. We want to be in the white area for all of these measures. And that says that we are managing, that the pandemic is managed, and that we are at a good place in Minnesota. And you'll see that we are not there. We are still very high in some of these areas. We have been improving thanks to the good hard work of all of Minnesotans. We are improving. But the other thing that we need to look at is herd immunity. And herd immunity can occur in one of two ways. One, it occurs when someone is infected and then survives the disease and recovers, and they have antibodies or immunity. And the other is through vaccine. So vaccination is the end game for this disease and this pandemic. Just because of limitations in supply, we are unfortunately in this for a while. The more vaccines that we get out there, the more herd immunity, obviously, the better off we're going to be. And we are going to see these risk measures move more into the white category. Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Assistant Commissioner Huff, so based on your experience in managing this pandemic to this point, can you anticipate when you think we will have a vaccination rate that brings us to herd immunity?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haley, that is 100% dependent upon how much vaccine we get in the state. You know, right now we are receiving 60,000 doses a week. At that rate, it would take 3.5 years to vaccinate every Minnesotan twice. We do know that more vaccines are coming online. We do know that we now have a national plan for vaccination and for addressing COVID. it is our anticipation, it is our great hope that that distribution rate will increase dramatically so that we can vaccinate much more quickly. We are prepared, as we have our pilot sites right now in the state, we are prepared to dramatically ramp up our vaccination rate as we receive vaccines from the federal government.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could have a lot of follow-up to that one, but I'll leave that for another discussion or later today. But I'd like to switch to another area that I had questions on, and I did make a note on this. I think this may have been your slide 19. And this was related to your discussion about balancing. I'll wait until that's up here. Yes. And Mr. Huff, I have said all along as we've been managing this pandemic that my goal as a legislator and serving my constituents has always been to balance public health and to balance the other impacts that this pandemic is having on our lives and on our economy. And when you talked about this, you referenced that your decision making has been an attempt to balance this. My concern is that we have not seen discussion from the administration on the other impacts, nor have we seen data points that show that we are considering, for example, businesses that have closed, people that have lost their entire livelihoods, the increase in suicides and depressions, the increase in other health issues when people haven't sought medical care in time, the learning loss. And you particularly in this discussion as well mentioned the lens of dealing with the disparities as this pandemic has been across our country. And we know for a fact children staying home from school is certainly having a great impact on everybody, but also increasing our terrible achievement gap. So I'm wondering, where is your data to look at these other impacts of the pandemic as we try to balance this decision-making?
Assistant Commissioner Hum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haley, I cannot speak for the economic data, but Commissioner Grove does track that. He reports that out to the governor every single day. I know that we look at, UI benefits. We look at the economic growth within each of the various sectors, jobless rates within the various sectors, number of businesses closing or opening. So Commissioner Grove has definitely been tracking that, and the governor is apprised of that every single day. Likewise, we look at impact on vulnerable populations as we go back to, and I'm wondering even if we could go back to one of Director Kelly's slides as we look at the structure. I think it may have been slide three. If we look at the structure here, each one of those boxes actually represents a different, or you'll see up in the yellow, a different work group. So we have a work group that is focused on education and childcare. We have a work group that is focused on worker protection, unemployment. We have a work group that's on vulnerable populations, including long-term care and people experiencing homelessness. So we have actually dedicated work groups that are all data-driven. I don't have the data on them, but I know I get to hear at the morning briefing every day. They report their progress to the governor. And so I will say that every part of this response and all of those other things that you just mentioned have definitely been, one, tracked, reported, and acted upon and managed to the point where we have an individual work group focused on every single one of those issues that you just brought up. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Huff. I appreciate your response, but I guess my rebuttal to that and my concern with that is that our constituents do not feel like they have a voice in these decisions. You may have work groups, et cetera, and I'm not going to debate that with you today. But I think the question going back to even Representative Garofalo's statement is our goal here is to figure out when the legislature that represents our constituents has a more significant role in making these decisions. And it's concerning to, I think, most of us, the rate of getting these vaccinations out so that we can reach some herd immunity. And your statistic on our current rate would take us 3.5 years. I can't imagine us being under executive powers and emergency powers for 3.5 years. So we, as a bipartisan team here, I think need to figure out how to have more folks at the table so that our constituents' voices are heard in this process. Thank you. Thanks for the presentation today.
Representative Lislegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to open up and say that it's no secret that that I voted 7 consecutive times in the special sessions to take up the governor's power. And it's no disrespect, and it's not to say that there isn't an emergency before us. But I was voted in to represent 40,000 people in my district, and to Representative Haley's point, I don't believe that their voice was heard. There was no access. And to Representative Garofalo's point is, I asked to be on this committee because I believe this committee does need to have full transparency, dig into it, and have that dialogue with the administration. When does this end? There's an expectation that as the numbers go down, restrictions start to loosen. This cannot be an almighty grab power, and I'm not suggesting that the governor has done that. I believe he has saved lives. But at what point is it no longer an emergency? I can tell you, you said 3 years if that was the case, 60,000 per month. I ain't going to support 3 years of emergency powers and executive powers. And the dialogue about where these decisions are being made. I mean, I don't understand why professional athletes, college athletes on the basketball court don't have to wear masks, but high school hockey and high school basketball players, but then high school wrestlers don't. You know, if it's truly about the health, that's the stuff that I need to be engaged in and have the voice heard from my district. Because as we sit in these committee meetings and we're having this discussion and we learn, and your presentation was incredible, Mr. Huff, and there's a lot of good information, and you have more information than we have. But our voice needs to be heard, and we need to have that dialogue. The worst thing for me is to have access to a meeting 2 hours before, but yet I go on KSTP and everything's already been leaked, and my constituents are turning on and calling me, and I'm trying to go through my email to see if I was sent that information. And so at some point this has to unwind. And I'm on this committee. I asked to be on this committee because we have to have these serious discussions to start to unwind this. And I look forward to working with everyone. This all or nothing approach by this far extreme people that think just get rid of it all, those are extreme people. And that's not where I'm at. I believe that certain powers need to stay in place. I want to learn about that more. But we do have to find how to open things up and let people move forward. Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner Huff, do you wish to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I think that those are points really well taken. And, you know, I would point back to the governor's letter. I think the governor is very anxious to engage with the legislature from an agency perspective. We do value and need your input. If we're to get through this as a state, I think the governor is the first to say we need to work together as a state. And so I would just want to highlight the governor's letter to that effect. And I'm happy, you know, if you'd like me to dive in deeper detail onto masking or on the youth sports masking, more than happy to do that, or any other parts there as well. Thank you.
Representative Lusigard, you wish a follow-up?
No, I look forward to the dialogue that this committee is going to have moving forward, the robust conversation and the engagement. Thank you.
All right, before I go to Representative O'Neill, this committee is going to have to end at 2:35. It is my intention a week from today to have another hearing and to pick up where we left off on this agenda, and we will likely be adding more to the agenda. So with that, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you having this committee. I appreciate this very much because it's been 11 months, and this is the first time that the legislature has engaged in this way. We're a divided legislature. We're the only divided legislature in the entire country. And it is even more so important that the legislature return to co-equal branches of government. We have three branches of government. We don't have two. And the legislature needs its power back, to be quite honest. In regards to the vaccine, there's only 40% of the vaccine has even been distributed. The distribution has been problematic, and I'll leave it at that. I want to present something for your consideration, and maybe the administration has not seen this yet because it was first published on January the 5th by the European Journal of Clinical Investigation. It's a Stanford study, and it's titled Assessing Mandatory Stay-at-Home and Business Closure Effect on the Spread of COVID-19. Now, it's a brand new study. It's been peer-reviewed. It has an entire team of people, Department of Medicine, Department of Health Policy, Epidemiology, Biomedical Data, Statistics, Metadata Research, are just a few of the departments that weighed in on this particular study. The study was conducted in 10 countries, England, France, Germany, Iran, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, South Korea, Sweden, and the United States. And they did a metadata analysis of the effects. The most egregious, if you are a civil rights person and care about people's liberties, most egregious effects upon the society, which were the stay-at-home orders and the business closures, versus the more minimal effects, the less restrictive. So they have more restrictive, like the business closures, and less restrictive, and they put them on a continuum. And I'll just tell you what their conclusion was for the sake of time. Well, small benefits cannot be excluded. We cannot find significant benefits on a case growth of more restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions. Similar reductions in case growth may be achieved with less restrictive interventions. So they're basically saying the higher the restriction, there's no bang for the buck. But on the converse of that, which is what Representative Haley said, is that the potential health harms are quite great, including hunger, opioid-related overdoses, missed vaccinations, increased disease from missed health services, domestic abuse, mental health, and suicide, as well as a whole host of economic impacts. So I would submit this to you. I told you already where it came from, that I'd ask that you would take a look at this study and review that. It's brand new, and it basically says stay-at-home orders and business closures have minimal or no effect or a negative effect on the spread of COVID and the overall health of the society, including the economic impacts. So I look forward to returning to a co-equal branch, and that should be the number one consideration of this committee in my estimation. Thank you. For the sake of time, I appreciate it. That's all I have to say. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Members, I have the time is 2:33, and this committee has to end at 2:35. So Representative Sandstead, I'm going to bring you up next, and then we are going to continue exactly where we left off a week from now and alert everyone who's on the agenda that we would like to have them back. So Representative Sandstead, you've got about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will keep this brief. I just really wanted to reiterate something that Representative O'Neill said. And I want to thank the presenters today for their work. I thought it was very thorough, very good, but this is the first time that we've been together. And for people who are listening in the general public, it is really important that they understand that during special session, members of either side found it very difficult to bring any issues forth unless there was five-way agreement between leadership. And it's good to be back in session. It's good to have committee process where we can hear from the public and we can have a thorough debate. And as one of my esteemed colleagues used to say, or still says, there is nothing special about a special session. And so I'm glad to be back in regular session and doing this work. And I do look forward to working with my colleagues to find a path forward for all of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we are at our allotted time.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dowd, but be brief, please.
I apologize. Just as the minority lead, there's a couple of things that I think we have to at least outline in the first session. And they're just questions I have for you. Can you outline what the scope of this committee is going to be? I see it as a short-term problem of the emergency powers immediately that are in effect, and then a long-term rewrite of Chapter 12. Is that what you anticipate? And then I'd like to know what we can expect for a timeline on both of those things. I really have a fear that businesses are going to start ignoring the emergency powers or the emergency orders that are in place, and I don't think anybody wants to see that.
Representative Dowd, that's exactly my position of this committee, that we're going to do at least a review of those two executive orders that we have on the agenda, and then once we are done with those, to proceed to however we can come to a compromise on Chapter 12. And I would like to build that in this committee through a series of drafts, so that we wouldn't have one bill before us, but we would have multiple things before us drafting that we could come to an agreement on. And I'm being told we're out of time, but I think you and I agree exactly where this is going to go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, I want to thank everyone, and I would hope that those members from the governor's office will return, and then we'll work on a little broader agenda for next week. Thank you, everyone. I think it's a good start. And with that, meeting is adjourned.